Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
For many years, the historical critical quest for reconstructing the origin and development of the Pentateuch or Hexateuch has coalesced around the documentary hypothesis, the heuristic power of which has produced a consensus so strong that an interpreter who did not operate within its framework was hardly regarded as a scholar. However, the relentless march of research has continued to bring new and refined analyses, data, methodological tools, and criticism. Join us as we speak with Dr. Roy E. Gain about the book Exploring the Composition of the Pentateuch, a volume that investigates new ideas about the composition of the Pentateuch arising from careful analysis of the biblical text against its ancient Near Eastern background. You're listening to New Books in Biblical Studies, a channel of the New Books Network, and I'm your host, Michael Morales. Roy Gain is professor of Hebrew Bible and Ancient Near Eastern Languages at Andrews University in Berean Springs, Michigan. He contributed a chapter and wrote the introduction for Exploring the Composition of the Pentateuch, and he's published many other works, including Cult and Character, Purification Offerings, Day of Atonement, and Theodicy, and also the NIV Application Commentary for Leviticus and Numbers. Roy, welcome to New Books in Biblical Studies.
Thank you. Good to be here with you.
Roy, tell us about yourself. How long have you been working in the Pentateuch, and what first sparked your interest in this part of the Bible?
Originally, I went to study at the University of California, Berkeley, to learn Hebrew after being an undergraduate at Pacific Union College in California, and I had no interest whatsoever in Leviticus, which turned out to be my specialty, Torah, Pentateuch. What I was interested in was prophets and Psalms. I wanted to learn more about the prophets because I love their literature, and I was curious about the nature of the prophecies. I was interested in Psalms because I'd been a piano performance major and was interested in music composition, and I wanted to be able to translate Psalms into a more regular meter so that I could set it to music for congregational singing, sort of like the bass psalter, but updated a lot. And so... And of course, with more natural flow of language rather than sort of bending the English. Anyway, so that's why I went to study Hebrew. And when I got there, I discovered that my major professor, the Hebrew Bible teacher in the Near Eastern Studies department at UC Berkeley, was Jacob Milgram. And when I learned that his specialty was Leviticus, my heart sank. I was very depressed about that. But I thought, I'll hang in there and maybe I can learn some Hebrew and then I can apply it to the other things that I'm really interested in. So I stuck in there, but he hijacked me. I got so interested in Leviticus, and it's not because he was a really charismatic, energetic teacher. He was charismatic in a quiet way, but not in the sense like, for example, Shalom Paul, who is very vigorous and that kind of thing, with whom I studied at the Hebrew University of Jerusalem later. But Milgram is very quiet and just let us think, and there were long pauses and so on and so forth. But it was so fascinating to see how everything fit together. First, we were in the book of Numbers and then the book of Leviticus, and spent a lot of time on Leviticus. As you know, he did the Anchor Bible Commentary on that, and he was working on that at the time. And so I remember one class period, we spent 2.5 hours not on a Hebrew chapter or verse or clause or phrase or word, but one Hebrew letter, a preposition bet in Leviticus 17:11. And we didn't resolve the issue. So, I mean, that was an extreme, but we were going through it very, very slowly with students who had command of a dozen or more languages. And so we'd be working through the text, looking at the history of the literature and what possible solutions there were for the different issues that came up. And very often, Milgram, after we had gone through the ancient versions and the Qumran material and the rabbinic material and the medieval Jewish commentators and the modern commentators, we didn't really have a solution to a particular issue. I remember this happening several times. And then Milgram would just show that within the biblical text itself, the answer was really there, and the scripture interpreted itself. And so I got very excited about that, very interested, and I could see this system of interconnected, cohesive concepts regarding God and his plan of salvation. And so I would be driving home an hour and a half from his house late at night, because his seminar was once a week at his house. I'd be driving home in my 62 Ford Falcon, shouting and banging on the steering wheel because I was so excited about this. So he really got me very interested in Leviticus, and that's become my scholarly specialty.
You wrote the introduction to this collection of essays on the composition of the Pentateuch. How did the idea for this book come about?
Yes, in the introduction to the book, I talk about how in 2014, I believe it is, if I get the date correctly, I was in an Ugaritic class with some students, a very small class, because not that many students want to take Ugaritic. But these two very serious students in the summer of 2014, Kenneth Berglund, one of the editors of this book, and Felipe Masotti. Now, Berglund is from Norway. Masotti is from Brazil. We have a very, very diverse international group of students here. But these were two really brilliant students, very interested in ancient languages and how the text is put together and so on. And so as we were reading Ugaritic texts, they saw, and I saw, we were looking at this together, that there were some aspects of the text that looked like what you could, if you were a historical source critic, if you were a historical critical source critic for the Pentateuch, you could make an argument that these could be multiple strands of authorship, but it's in an ancient Ugaritic epic. Now, how could this be? Was there a JEDP in the Ugaritic authorship tradition? What's going on here? So they were curious about that. And as a result, then, they started something called the Torah Group. And that that fall, a few months after that. And they got with other PhD students and some faculty members and so on, and also connecting with others from other places in the world, including even the Philippines. And we have there's the Adventist International Institute of Advanced Studies in the Philippines. So connecting with people in various parts of the world to hash through the different issues. And it's a very complex kind of a thing, as they realized. And it's a multidisciplinary kind of area of research. And so they involve linguists and archaeologists and historians and text people and so on and so forth. Well, the next fall it was in... Was it 2015? Yes, 2015. Berglund and Masotti and I were in another class together. This time it was Hittite. And we were studying Hittite laws. And that furthered the interest. How are these laws put together? We could see different levels of explicit composition in the Hittite laws because there were later changes to the laws that were made and so on, and these are really documented. And so how does that relate? So out of this and the Torah group grew the interest of putting together a conference. And so these people, Berglund and Masotti and then some others, Scotty Baker, who is an archaeology PhD student, and he's finished now. Kenneth Berglund is finished also with his PhD, but Rahel Wells is a text person and with her degree from Wheaton. And so they got together the idea of a Torah conference to discuss this issue of the composition of the Pentateuch. So of course, I was delighted that they were interested in doing this and at their get up and go. And so we did. We have a Torah conference, and that was the basis of this book. Now, this book is not just the whole project. The project is much bigger than this book, because we did hold the conference in 2016, but then the idea was put together to have a conference every 2 years. So we did have a conference in 2018, and another volume is coming out of that one. It's in the process of being edited. And we planned to have a conference in 2020. We had the date, everything was all set, and then COVID hit, so we couldn't do it. And the folks involved really didn't want to do it at a distance, just by Zoom. They wanted to just put it off, maybe 2021, until we can get together. So the group of scholars, though, that were pulled together for this book are from five continents in terms of their origin, and from a number of different countries, of course, and they involve evangelical scholars, a number of people from here at Andrews University, but others from other places, Trinity and Wheaton and others, and a Catholic scholar and a Jewish scholar. So it's really, we're trying to reach out to a broad base. And in fact, the next conference, we're going to have more Jewish scholars involved, and it's becoming even more diverse like that. So the thing that we have in common is all of us are curious. We're curious about how this works. And of course, it's been under debate for two centuries, the whole idea of the composition of the Pentateuch, getting into, of course, the crystallization of the documentary hypothesis with Graf and Wellhausen, particularly Wellhausen, and 19th century German approach to source criticism, and then the development of redaction, source, form criticism, tradition criticism, and all the rest of it. And what we have in common among the people involved in this project is that we think that the criticism needs to be criticized. It needs to be, we need to critique everything. And are there better ways of looking at things? And we're interested in criticizing it, not because we happen to be a fundamentalist bunch of, people who are trying to put science down. For one thing, we're not fundamentalists. And for another thing, we are interested in good science of text, rather than just starting with assumptions that rule out possibilities. We want to leave the possibilities open. But the crucial areas of research that we're into, we're looking at coherence of texts. And we did a lot with that in our 2018 conference, but there's some in here. Coherence of texts, because some of the main reasons why scholars divide Torah texts and other biblical texts into different sources is on the basis of disjunctions, what they perceive to be differences, disjunctions, or reduplications, or apparent contradictions in text. So they say these really didn't fit together. We have a seam here between two different portions of text. And what we've discovered and are in the process of trying to work with is that rather than imposing modern Western approaches to literary coherence upon a group of ancient texts, we need to find out what did literary coherence mean for ancient people. And so we're looking at scribal practices. We're looking at other documents, Mesopotamia, Egypt, and so on, and Hittite, of course, looking at the question of what did coherence mean to them? And what we're discovering is that it wasn't exactly the same as what it means to us. So that it doesn't really rule out, there are pretty clear cases of ancient texts that have unity of authorship, or at least there's no evidence that they don't. And yet they have a development of tradition, particularly in canonical texts. You get Atrahasis and Gilgamesh, Etana, even the Temple Scroll, we see development and so on from how it's put together. The text itself gives some indications of that. So rather than start with a set of criteria that we then impose on the text and say it has to be coherent and we use our logic to sort of separate it up, let's look at the ancient texts, compare them with the biblical texts, look at the literary structure of the biblical texts and the scribal tradition, and an empirical kind of approach that, you know, Tige wrote on that, and also Josh Berman has worked on that, and so on. An empirical approach looking at what is the evidence that is really empirical data in the ancient Near East that is literary and historical, archaeological, and so on, that we can then look at the text and get answers. And one of the interesting papers and now essays in this volume was discovering that, in fact, it was written by one of our students. It was written by Scotty Baker and Rahel Wells, who's a faculty member here in the undergraduate school. And what they found is in Egyptian texts, you can have multiple phases of the language in the same text, represented in the same texts, so that you get – it's very difficult to say that because there's a certain stage of language here, and this is dated to a certain period, that therefore we have another kind or phase of the language alongside of it. Say Exodus 15, you know, Song of the Sea, which is generally regarded as very early Hebrew poetry. You get this next to the rest of the text, and it doesn't mean that they are not different periods. It doesn't mean that they're not different sources, but the fact that they are there in close proximity doesn't prove that either, because in ancient Near Eastern texts, you could have that kind of phenomenon in place, where there are reasons for selecting different phases of the language, just like we use sometimes archaic language to make a point. Even sometimes when, particularly some older people, when they pray in King James Version English. All right? You probably heard that too.
Your essay's chapter 11, it's entitled, Was Leviticus Composed by Aaronite Priests to Justify Their Cultic Monopoly? Can you tell us where that question comes from and how you respond to it in your essay?
This question comes from my friend James Watts. And he has written about this ritual and rhetoric in Leviticus from sacrifice to scripture. He published that in 2007. And Jim and I are very good friends. We have very different approaches to the composition of the Pentateuch. He believes that it's late Persian period and so on. So he's very much with the sort of the more traditional scholarly consensus in that regard. Although these days, of course, there's a lot of variety in terms of the way scholars approach the documentary hypothesis. People talk about P or H or J-E and so on. They mean quite different things in some respects. So in any case, in Ritual and Rhetoric in Leviticus, James Watts argued for, his main point was that the purpose of Leviticus 1 to 16, so he's looking at the so-called P or priestly section of Leviticus, the purpose of this was to establish the authority of the priests and their monopoly over the cult. So it's a priestly hierarchy. And this was finally put in place. It was actuated and fulfilled during the Second Temple period. Now, he's careful not to say that, therefore, Leviticus had to be composed, or Leviticus 1 to 16 composed during the Second Temple period. But that's the period which was when things were actually done and fulfilled. So it could have been written at any time previously to that. But the main point is that it was written by priests for priests. And it was to convince the other people that they should respect the priests and of course, bring their perquisites or prebends so that from their sacrifices, there were priestly portions that the priests would get. And that all benefited the priests. Now, I wrote an article in response to that, an essay in the Festschrift that, well, it was really a memorial volume for Jacob Milgram, which I edited with Ada Tiger Cohen, and that was in, I think, 2015, if I'm remembering correctly. So the Milgram Memorial Volume, and I wrote a piece called Didactic Logic in Leviticus. And so my point was that whereas, the legacy of Jacob Milgram and beyond. It's current issues in priestly and related literature, the legacy of Jacob Milgram and beyond, edited by Roy Gain and Ada Tiger Cohen. And so in my essay, Didactic Logic in Leviticus, I was pointing out that whereas Watts says that the purpose of Leviticus 1 to 16 is persuasion for the purpose of benefiting the priests, and he asked the question, who stood to benefit by this work. And therefore, he assumed that that was going to be the author. And I discovered by analyzing the same texts that really the purpose of this was didactic. It's to teach. Yes, persuasive, and persuasive to teach that this is the right kind of way to go. But I discovered that it was not really to establish a priestly monopoly. In fact, in some respects, it's quite critical of the priests. I mean, you have, for example, Nadab and Abihu, who, when the whole cult was being inaugurated, they used unauthorized fire, and they were slain by God. Other aspects also. In Leviticus chapter 16, God warns Aaron, after the death of Nadab and Abihu, be very careful when you go into the Holy of Holies once a year, because you got to do it the right way or else you'll die. And so it's clear that the target audience, those who are being regulated and restricted and instructed, are the priests, as well as the other people. And what I found were about, I think, 10 different indicators of rhetorical or rather didactic strategies. They're rhetorical, but they're didactic, literary strategies, ways that you teach people. Building on previous information and sometimes abbreviating and doing various other things, various strategies that we all use as teachers. And so this then led me to the conclusion in that piece that the authorship of Leviticus was probably not priestly, but rather prophetic. We have here in the narrative framework of Leviticus, it's Moses who is receiving the messages from God, except a few times Aaron and Moses. So it's really Moses in the function of a prophet, not as a priest, who's telling the priest what to do. Now, in this piece, in this book, now, I built on that and pointed out that the idea of priestly monopoly is not something that is in the foreground in Leviticus, and you expect that the foreground information is the thrust, the purpose of a composition, right? Mm-hmm. But it's assumed, it's in the background. And this is assumed for the book of Exodus, that the priests are going to be in charge and so on. And furthermore, the idea of priests having a monopoly and having perquisites and prebends, that is not established by Leviticus. That is just well known in the ancient Near East. That's the function of priests. And priests always get prebends and things that they live on. For example, in the text from Amar, I believe it is the installation of the storm god's high priestess, if I'm remembering correctly, the high priestess text there. And she is assigned her yearly allowance that she's going to get really quite a bit of food and other kinds of things every year. And that's really the way priesthood works in the ancient days. It's just part of the definition of priesthood. So it doesn't have to be established by Leviticus. That's one thing. And then furthermore, the idea of cultic control by the priests, is that waiting until the Second Temple period? And the answer is no, because you already have it in 1 Samuel with the sons of Eli, Hophni and Phinehas. They clearly have a monopoly and control. Now, they're abusing it, that's true, but they have that kind of control at that time. So that really undermines the idea, then, that you're really waiting for this control until the Second Temple period. And then there's other evidence for early authority in 1 Samuel and so on. But then, at the end, I tackle the problem of pseudonymous authorship of Leviticus, because according to Watts, Leviticus is pseudonymous, written by Moses, but Moses is really not the author. It was priests who used a very well-known character, and they put it in the mouth of Moses, so it's really fictitious authorship. Just the way in the Second Temple period, very commonly, you have the Testament of Abraham or the Testament of Levi and so on, or the books of Enoch, and they would write compositions and put them in the mouths of very, very ancient people whom everybody knew about, and it would give greater authority to the book. People would listen to it. And so is that what's going on in Leviticus here? And then I raise some questions, problems with that. One of the problems is that when you have pseudonymous authorship, you always want to have your composition based on something that's very well known, right? However, if, as many scholars say, the Book of Leviticus originated in exilic or post-exilic times, okay, and Moses is pseudonymous, but Moses is the one in the Pentateuch and the Torah, which is exilic or post-exilic, what sense does it make to have Moses be the pseudonymous author if he's not established by history? You have to have some kind of tradition of someone being famous for pseudonymity to work. And it's not going to work if the Torah, with all the information about Moses, is so late. And now you're talking about, oh, this guy, famous guy Moses. Oh, well, he's the one right here in these books that are late. No, it doesn't work. Pseudonymity doesn't work that way. Furthermore, I question the issue of ruling out the historicity of Moses, because that's what many scholars do. They won't even consider the possibility that there really was a historical Moses. And I'm not saying that we have proof that there was Moses. We know that we do not have any autographs from the text that he wrote. We don't have any say statues of him like we do of Gudea in Sumer, those kinds of things that really would bait him in that way. But as Kenneth Kitchen pointed out, the characteristics of whoever the author is of these Pentateuchal books has to be someone from the Nile Delta region at a certain period who understood international treaties. He also is fully conversant with Hebrew lore and logic and tradition and so on and so forth. And Kenneth Kitchen says this wonderful line. He says, in other words, we need somebody distressingly like the old hero of biblical tradition, Moses, is badly needed at this point. In other words, if there were not a historical Moses, we would have to have somebody just like him. Okay, so these are various kinds of arguments. Furthermore, when you come to Gudea, now Gudea was about 2100 BC. He was the NC or the governor of Lagash in southern Mesopotamia. And historians of ancient Mesopotamia do not doubt the existence of Gudea. Okay, and they don't doubt the existence of a lot of other prophets. Now, Gudea claims in his cylinders in Sumerian to have received revelations from his god, Ningirsu, instructing him to build a sanctuary, a temple, which he did for Ningirsu and his consort, Baba. Okay, Moses also received instructions from his deity. Oh, but that's got to be legend. That's got to be fiction. So we're going to believe Gudea, but we're not going to believe Moses. Oh, is that really consistent? You see? In other words, it's true that we don't have the evidence for Moses like we do for Gudea, say cylinders that are dated to that period, or statues of Moses like we do of Gudea, those diorite statues that we've seen. We don't have anything like that, but there are a number of reasons why we don't have the original autographs, the original evidence. Because, for one thing, very few copies. It's in parchment, which is all subject to fire and decay and everything. And then when we find in the historical books, in the Bible, we find Hilkiah, the high priest, in the reign of Josiah, and he finds, oh, wow, lo and behold, we've got the book of the law. So it was very rare, and for these various reasons, and therefore we can explain why there would be paucity of evidence. It makes good sense. So for these and other reasons, there are other reasons as well, I just refuse to rule out on scientific grounds the possibility of Moses. I say at the end of the chapter, to acknowledge the uncertainty of excluding the possibility that Leviticus 1-16 was authored by a historical Moses functioning as a prophet is not to adopt unscholarly credulous faith and tradition over true critical scholarly science. This uncertainty is simply a matter of fact and logic, objectively acknowledging the limits of available historical evidence regarding a canonical ancient Near Eastern composition. And dating canonical compositions in the ancient Near East is notoriously difficult. For example, if you look at ancient Near Eastern texts edited by Pritchard, 3rd edition, Princeton, 1969, and you look there under the schedule for the New Year's Festival in Babylon, you see that it's reconstructed from Seleucid-era texts. These are very late texts in the Greek period, after Babylon no longer has hegemony over the area. And Seleucid texts, and yet there's a footnote there in Pritchard's volume, and it says, This likely reflects much earlier practices and customs. Okay, so there's canonical texts that have been copied and recopied and recopied. And so when you read about this, you can't assume that because the tablets themselves are clearly Seleucid era, that those practices and those texts were originated in that period, because there was a very, very long canonical tradition. The same is true with the biblical text.
Before we let you go, Roy, would you like to highlight some of the other chapters in this volume of essays?
I could highlight all of them. I've just gone over, in fact, today, just to review for this, the introductions and conclusions to refresh my memory, because I heard them all and I've read them all, but just to refresh my memory. But Hesse's, for example, is pointing out that there's an inscription that's been sort of neglected by scholars from Hebron. Hebron is where, of course, Abraham is buried, Cave of Machpelah, and it's in from the territory of Judah. It's in the south. There are very few texts outside the Bible from this era. And yet, looking at this text, which Hesse does, he analyzes it and finds that there are significant similarities with the time frame of Abraham. And of course, this text can be dated. And the kinds of animals that they have, the kinds of rulership that's in the surrounding era, this text is sort of formulaic with lists. And scholars have assumed that this kind of information was generally carried on by oral tradition, and that there couldn't have been writing in this era. It all had to be oral. And Hesse is pointing out, no, here we have a text which is very early, showing that there's no reason why someone like Moses couldn't have been writing this kind of stuff, and there couldn't have been written records, and why it couldn't have been formulaic. So what we're looking at in this volume is we're not finding proof, okay? But what we're doing is finding models of different ways that things could have happened other than the 19th century and following kind of source criticism, and now neo-documentarianism, which is resurrecting and, you know, refining JEDP and H and so on and so forth by like Joel Baden and Jeffrey Stackert and so on. So we're questioning those things based upon, in this case, empirical data, which is discovered by archaeology. And here we have a text with that kind of information. Now, one thing about the authorship, what I mentioned before about the authorship of Moses, we're not saying by any means, none of us are claiming that Moses wrote the entire Pentateuch. It's very clear that the Pentateuch is a compiled group of documents, and that there's editing going on, and there's likely updating of language and so on. So, but it's that Moses could have been the primary author. And the authors in this volume have differing approaches about some things. I mean, how close do we get to the idea of thinking that really it was Moses, or maybe it was just pre-exilic? What is the nature of law in biblical times? And, for example, Josh Berman points out it's not like our statutory law. It was more like common law. But then Daniel Block says, well, to some extent, the Ten Commandments, for example, and other things look a bit more like statutory law, so there could have been sort of a spectrum over that. And then Kenneth Berglund, one of the really who has been the spearhead of this whole thing, Kenneth Berglund suggests that it's really covenantal, normative covenantal instruction is the key idea of how to characterize the law, the legal portions. And so we have some differences and nuances, and that's okay. We're just kind of hashing it out. So we're not trying to shut down discussion with this. We're trying to open up discussion, but we're trying to open it up in ways that have been not opened up so much in the past.
Do you have any other publications on the horizon?
Well, in terms of, there is a 2018 conference volume that is the successor to this that's coming out. And particularly, there's quite a big emphasis there in the question of what constitutes literary cohesion or coherence. And so we have a number of presentations on those issues. So we're pursuing some things that we couldn't get to here and so on. In terms of, you're asking about my own personal publications?
Yes.
Ah, okay. Well, I've been working on Leviticus, putting together a lot of material for Leviticus, and I hope to be, I'm still working on nailing down a publisher for that, but I hope to publish a commentary on that. And I've been working on a number of other projects involving article projects and things like that. I'm very interested in questions such as the transfer of sin in Leviticus. How does it get to the sanctuary so that it needs to be removed? And of course, I addressed that in my Cult and Character several years ago. But then there's been pushback by some scholars on that. And I have more information. I've been studying more on that. So I'd like to do some writing on that, maybe put together a monograph on that sometime. We'll see. And so it's just an ongoing, wonderful exploration. Jacob Milgram got me off to a start. And I know that you're involved in a commentary right now. And it's very challenging putting this together. There's never an end to it. It's a messy process. And so there's a question of what do we put in? What do we leave out? How do we emphasize? How do we make it interesting to modern people and practical for their benefit, particularly for those who really regard Scripture, take it seriously. It's not just a game. It is from God, we believe. And of course, the issue of Moses and the authorship of the Pentateuch, which touches your work and my work, the question of Moses is the authority of the Pentateuch. Because if, as Scripture claims, and the whole narrative structure of the Pentateuch claims that Moses received revelations from God, then as it claims, this is like the voice of God. I mean, God could have spoken directly, but the people were afraid. And so they said, Moses, you go up and hear what God has to say. And so God told Moses and Moses told them as if it was God directly speaking to them. And so we have this in the Pentateuchal narrative. I prefer to work with that in understanding the theology of the Pentateuch within its own narrative framework, the way it wants to be understood, okay, rather than inventing or adopting an entirely different, a speculative, fictitious narrative framework that's been adopted by modern scholars. I prefer to stay with what a text says about itself. I think that's more valid, sticking with the data. Now, whether a person wants to agree with that or not, in other words, whether they want to believe that God spoke to Moses or not, that's up to them. But at least let's work with the theology of the Pentateuch such that we interpret it in light of it believes, the Pentateuch, the authorship believes that that's what happened. And so I should understand that in terms of what it's presenting about itself. Now, I do personally believe that because I accept the Torah as God's word. But I think that's a more scientific approach. And not only more scientific, I think that it puts us on a much more solid ground for getting guidance in modern world, navigating through all the complexities and the pitfalls of our lives. We see principles that are in the Torah. And I've written about those in my book, Old Testament Law for Christians, which principles in the Torah that are so wise and helpful for modern people, if we would just listen to them. And then, of course, we have to realize that those principles come to us dressed in examples and applications that are in ancient Near Eastern dress. But we have to interpret, we have to look and see within that framework, we have to find out what are they really trying to say to us. And there is so much more. And my life is being enriched and enhanced and made more peaceful and more effective as a result of digging into those things. And I think that can happen for other people as well.
Roy, as always, it's been a joy spending time in your company. Thank you for being with us.
It's a pleasure. Thank you, Michael, for the invitation.
All right, friends, you've been listening to New Books in Biblical Studies, a channel of the New Books Network. Until next time, goodbye.